Well, hello.
Hello.
It's so good to be here. I come down. I try and come down quite well regularly. I've been down a few times over the past couple of years, and I always love coming down to Croydon. It's such a friendly lot. It's so such a nice feel about the place, and with this lovely shrine room, it's just even better. It's just sublime. So I was going to do this talk in December. And then, disappointingly, I fell and broke my arm. So just a few days before, so I couldn't come. But in a way, it's been quite fortuitous, because in the meantime, I've actually been to India, and I've been on a retreat and a convention and with lots of other people. And then Amra Pushpa and I, we did a pilgrimage for a week around the sites where the Buddha went. So in a way, this has really sort of widened my knowledge and sense of where the Buddha was. And as Vijayashree said, my name means she who walks the path of the Buddha, or who walks in the footsteps of the Buddha. So that's literally what I was doing, what we were doing in that week. So this is sort of, in a way, this is colour what I'm going to say. Although I'm not going to talk about it in detail, but... So I started off thinking about this talk on my ordination retreat just over a year ago. Because I had 3 months, I thought, well, what a really good opportunity to look at the Pali Canon, because I know quite a few of the suttas, but I'd never really studied the Pali Canon at all, not sort of just sat down and read it. So I thought, it's something I ought to do. So, and I decided to concentrate on the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle length. That seemed like a good place to start. It was quite thick, about 150 suttas. So it was a bit of a challenge. And I was a bit daunted. Anyway, I tried to think, if I just read one sutta a day, that would be enough. That'll get me. I'll read them all then over the 3 months. No, that don't quite work out, does it? Must have been two suttas a day. So that's what I decided to do, and I started reading it, and I found the first sutra is quite a difficult one, so I found that, I'm not sure about this. But then as I got into it, I got hooked. It was the most surprising thing, really. I made a point of not reading all the repetition, because it is quite formalised and it is quite archaic in places. So it was sort of accepting that and reading, just reading the bits that really, trying to distill it down into what that sutta was about and reading the really relevant bits. And it was just wonderful. And I really enjoyed it, and I want to read more of the Pali Canon. Perhaps when I go on a solitary retreat, I might take another one. A year or two ago, I read Vishvapani's book as well. I don't know, has anybody read it? Gautama Buddha. Yeah. It's the most wonderful book as well, because it's not romanticised at all. He talks about the Buddha in a way that is very real, and the way the Buddha would be. So that's a real favourite, and it's been an important source of content for this talk. So those two things made me want to put a talk together, and I wanted to convey a little bit of what it might have been like to be around the Ganges Valley in 2,500 years ago, and what it would be like to see the Buddha and what was happening there at the time, and to relate some of the stories in the Pali Canon, and to try and get a feel for the Buddha himself. Because we can sometimes have this sort of idealised image of the Buddha, which is fine. But I wanted to get closer. I wanted to get in closer to the Buddha. So I'm going to invite you to join me on this adventure. And we're going to go through the dusty tracks of northern India. And they are very dusty. I can vouch for that. We're going to go through the dense forests of the Ganges Valley and into the noisy cities. So, just a bit about a bit more about the Pali Canon. It's got so much in it, When I finished it, I thought, wow, this is a bit like a soap opera. There's all sorts of things. There's thousands of people. There's colourful characters. There's heroes and villains. Ordinary people, murderers, kings, politics, spiritual skullduggery, lots of that. traditional spiritual practices and superstitions, and any number of religious sects who all claimed that they knew the true way and that they'd found out the secret of what life was about. And it's also a big social record of all sorts of things, what people wore, what they ate, the crops they grew, the social customs, the houses they built, the trades, and the occupations, and also the social structure of the time. And the suitors are set against the backdrop of massive impenetrable forests. So when you go to India today, to northern India, around the Ganges, it's a very peculiar sort of landscape. It's not, it's talked, I'm calling it the Ganges Valley, but it isn't really. It's a vast Ganges plain. So the Ganges itself, I was shocked. I was really shocked. I've been to India about 20 years ago, and I did go on the Ganges at Varanasi, and it was evening, but I realised you couldn't see the other side. It was vast. It was very wide. But then on the pilgrimage, we actually drove over the Ganges twice on the bus. And it went on and on and on. And I think it must have been, about a mile and a half, getting up to 2 miles wide. So we think sort of the Thames is a big river. And up where I come from, the ooze and the air. But they're not. Compared to the Ganges, they're just tiny, really. So the Ganges, this huge river, and then beyond it, you've got this plain that lasts for, I don't know, maybe 200 miles on either side. And at this time, when the Buddha was around, or when all this was going on in the Ganges Valley, it was completely forested. There was dense jungle all the way over it. Nowadays, there isn't. It's just, there's no jungle. There's hardly any jungle around. But then it was, there was lots of jungle, and it was impenetrable. So that's the sort of physical thing, and then in the Indian season, there's the hot season, the cold season, and the rainy season. So in India, there's three seasons, and in the Pali Canon, there's all sorts about the different seasons and about the flora and fauna and all the natural things in India. And as I say, a social chronicle, a historical record, which is really, scholars have used it to work out a lot of the history of India and of the Buddha, of course. And the Buddha. So right at the centre of all this is Siddhartha Gautama, the Buddha, who was a wandering religious mendicant, as you know, unfailingly polite, charming and kind. Well, that's how I see him anyway. So he appeared something like 500 years before the birth of Christ, so 2,500 years ago. And Banti said this is a significant period in the world, really significant, he calls it an axial period in the world, of social and political and spiritual ferment. And in Greece at the time, so it wasn't just in India, in Greece there was Pericles and Sophocles and Socrates, formulating their theory about life, and it was a kind of golden age in Greece, which is still sort of reverberating in the West. And in China, Confucius was developing his philosophy, and Taoism was on the rise as well. And then in Judea, the tribal culture of the Jewish nation had arisen, so there was lots going on there. And there would be other places in the world where things were happening. And where there was this sort of change in the nature of the way things were in terms of politics and spirituality. So the world was changing in radical ways. This applied even more to India, I think. And Sangharakshita says, very broadly speaking, the age in which the Buddha lived was an age of transition from old values to new values, from the ethnic to the universal, from the group to the individual, from Vedic Hinduism to Buddhism. So it was really exciting times. And I've called this talk Spiritual Fire Sweeping Through the Ganges Valley, because that's how it feels. There was just this amazing time when there was all this stuff going on and change was afoot. So India at that time, or northern India, comprised of 16 states. Some of them were ruled over by kings, and some of them were ruled over by elected officials. And indeed, that's where Gautama came from the state where they had elected officials. And his father, that's what his father was. So agriculture was thriving. Iron tools had recently been imported from Persia, it was like a revolution, because suddenly with really useful iron tools they could remove trees and they could plough the land more effectively, and they could take over big areas to turn over to agriculture, and they could reclaim some of the forest. And the Ganges Plain, because it's a floodplain, that the soil was very, very fertile. So they were able to produce lots and lots of food. So farming populations moved in to colonise the new land. And it was well watered, it was flat and it was fertile. So there was also an urban civilization emerging. There wasn't that many people in India at the time. It wasn't hundreds of millions like it is now, so it was quite sparsely populated. But there was prosperous cities that were growing, and this was fueled, and the business in the cities was fueled by some really busy trade routes that ran across northern India, and they passed through the Ganges Valley, and these trade routes went from the west, from Persia and beyond, and the Middle East, right through to Sri Lanka in the south, and to Burma, Thailand and Southeast Asia to the east. And so these were really popular routes, because they were the only routes through this dense forest, and they connected the popular areas. But they were... they were dangerous. You can imagine, the Buddha went into the forest, but really most people didn't want to, because there was lots of wild animals there. There was tigers, apparently there was Asiatic lions, which I never realised, elephants, rhinoceroses, black bears and water buffaloes. And that was only the half of it, because as well there was bandits and dangerous tribesmen who would murder people and rob travellers as they went past. So people banded together to go along these trade routes, and so you might find there was several hundred ox-drawn wagons trundling along these trade routes, and they were filled with goods to trade across the region and beyond. And they were useful, because it meant that other people could tag along and it was quite safe. And often there would be soldiers going with them or paid militia to actually protect the convoys. So ordinary people used them, and thousands of shramanas used them now as well, these wandering mendicants, spiritual mendicants. And some of these, I was pleased to hear, were women. So they were also part of all this. Which is good. So there were several hundred, you might get several hundred of the sect tagging along with a convoy and wandering from city to city. And northern India at the time was a melting pot of different spiritual traditions. The traditional Vedic religion was a communal one. It was well adapted to sort of small scale communities. But it was less adaptable to the larger urban centres that were springing up. So in a way the Vedic religion was sort of a little bit was struggling a little bit in the towns and cities, and in the local villages people very much followed apparently the traditional spiritual practice. They would have their own spirits and their own shrines, and they would spend a lot of time looking after these spirits and mollifying them and making sure that they were happy and that they didn't cause problems for them. And the new urban people, they wanted more of a religious, more of a personal religious experience. They were really interested in the knotty problems of death and rebirth, and they wanted to know what is the correct way to act. There were so many different views on this that it was very confusing for people. There was hundreds of different views, lots of different people, and everybody was convinced that their way was the right way. So these people, they were somewhat confused, and they were struggling to find out, what can I do to make sure that my rebirth is good and auspicious? And Jainism was one of the dazzling array of new religions that emerged as a major force, and they promoted asceticism, is it, and non-violence. But there were lots of others. There was those who believed there was no free will, and there were skeptics, and lots of other diverse beliefs, like accepting or denying the concept of soul, fatalism or free will, idealization of extreme asceticism. So people who really went to the extremes of hunger and discomfort, of which the Buddha was one, eventually. And people who believed in family life, non-violence, vegetarianism, and others who believed that violence was fine, and that you could eat meat as much as you want. So there were so many views, and every view was forcibly argued, of course, both with the local people and particularly between the different groups of Shramanas. But the Shramana tradition was doing really well. It was really thriving, because there'd already been a long tradition of giving alms in India. And so the Shramana communities could prosper. They could research their particular beliefs, and they were well looked after by the locals. And in fact, every city had parks and groves on the outskirts, which were home to the travelling Shramanas. And we saw a few of these, and the one that stood out for me was at Shravasti, which was Anathapindika's park or Jetta Grove, and that was vast. It was really vast and beautifully kept, and you could imagine all these groups all sort of hunkering down there and meditating or doing whatever they did, standing on one leg and doing the various things that they did. I could see them when we were there, and it was like just it would be a real hubbub, you know. It was a really quiet park when we were there, and but there would have been a real hubbub in these parks, because there would be a motley lot. They would be completely out of this world, really. There would be many with really long matted hair and long curling nails, very very long curling nails, because some of them never cut the nails. Some pulled all the hair out forcibly from the bodies, so they were completely bare of hair. Some had filthy dreadlocks. Probably most of them never washed, or a lot of them, certainly. And, of course, quite a lot went naked or just wore a loincloth. And they would cover themselves with dirt or ash. And in India today, you still see, I think the Jains out there, that go about covered in sort of grey look. Which is very fashionable, apparently. I'm naked. And there were those who never sat down, or who never drank cold water, or constantly sat on one leg, or ate, sat on one leg, stood on one leg, or ate dung, or lied on thorns or nails. So this thing about the bed of nails is true. And some would squat continuously or hold their breath until they passed out, which is of course what the Buddha did at one time. And there are also in the Majjhima Nikaya, there are tales of people who lived like animals. There was there's the Sutra of the Dog Duty Ascetic and the Ox Duty Ascetic. And they lived like, they believed that if you lived like a dog and ate off the ground and walked on all fours, then that would eradicate all your bad karma. And the Buddha put them right, actually. So there was constant argument, disagreement and debate among all these people. And then into this heady mix came the Buddha. And the texts describe him as shaven-headed. But I don't think it's like we would see people shaven-headed now, which is sort of quite shiny and clean and quite trim. The Buddha would be covered, his head would be covered in stubble, his chin would be covered in stubble. And his robes, they're often depicted as, we think, you know, beautiful silk robes, but in fact they were just rags. And even if he had robes donated, just wandering around India all the time and living rough, they would soon deteriorate. And he carried a wooden or metal begging bowl, of course. And I think from a distance he probably was indistinguishable from most of the other wandering mendicants. He was just this ascetic who was walking through India. And then he became enlightened, and he would still be like that. But he was not quite like everybody else. In fact, he wasn't at all like everybody else, I don't think. He was very different. For a start, one of the things that seems very apparent from the Pali Canon, from the Majjhima Nikaya, is that he was unfailingly polite to everybody, even his enemies. He listened to other people carefully. He was charming, and he was truthful and direct, but he was kind. He comes across as an extraordinary individual. And he was of quiet demeanour, but people said that his presence was like the massive grandeur of an elephant. And his goodwill emanated from him like some kind of force field. So wherever the Buddha was, he had this amazing effect on people just by being there and just by just giving off this kindness and this something else that people couldn't quite pin down. Not only that, he was very skilled in debate. The Buddha was obviously wise, but he was able to use his wisdom in very skillful ways. And he tried to put people at ease, and to whoever they were, whether they were farmers or criminals or Brahmins or religious mendicants from another sect, he would put them at their ease. And he said in himself in the Sandakan Sutta, he says, "I match my appearance to their appearance. I match the sound of my voice to the sound of theirs, and instructed them with talk about the teaching, encouraging, enthusing, and inspiring them." And I found, when I came across that quote, I found it really interesting, because when you're doing the Carinder appeal, one of the things the teachers is, when you knock on the door and somebody opens it, try and match the way they are with the way you are, so that you put them at ease. So we would actually talk to a fairly fragile old person in a completely different way to a young man, and it really did put people at ease. So that's what the Buddha did, that's where that came from. And he never disagreed with others directly. They may be telling him things that he really didn't agree with, but he would listen to them, and he would use their beliefs as a way into his Dharma, and he would turn back their arguments in a very skillful way until they could see that his way was right. And he used skillful metaphors and similes. So he related things to the different trades and professions of people. So it was very, very personal for people. And in one discourse, he compares the 11 skills of a good cowherd with the 11 qualities of a good disciple. Which is lovely, isn't it? And there's another discourse on the simile of elephants, where he talks about the elephant's footprints and the analogy of a woodsman tracking down a big bull elephant to show how a disciple arrives at a complete certainty of the truth of the Buddha's teaching. So this sort of tracking thing, and there's all sorts of things about deers and hunting and all to do, all sort of around what the Buddha's teaching was about. So over and over he uses his wisdom for the benefit of others. He did that for something like 45 years. Just ordinary people like Kissa Gotami and helping her over the death of her child and her grief. And Angulimala even being kind to a mass murderer and through that getting him to change his ways and become a disciple. He taught noblemen, the young Sigala, about respectful relationships. And there was famously his relationship with Bimbisara, the king. And other wanderers, you probably know the story about Bahia, who travelled right across India because he'd heard about the Buddha, and the Buddha was on his arms round. And he really wanted to do his arms round. He didn't teach when he was on his arms round, but Bahia wouldn't leave him alone. And eventually he gave just a pithy teaching to Bahia, and Bahia became enlightened. And so he didn't discriminate between people of different social status or castes, and in fact he opposed the caste system. He opposed what was beginning to be the caste system at the time, and there were four castes. And in the Esukari Sutta, the Brahmin Esukari outlines the four castes: the Brahmin, the noble, the merchant, and the worker. And he's telling the Buddha that the worker at the bottom has to support the three above, and then the next one up has to support the two above, and the next one up just has to support the Brahmin, and the Brahmin doesn't have to support anybody, and the Brahmin is at the top of the pile. And he asks the Buddha what he thinks, and the Buddha says, no, there's a better system, there's a much better system. And he says, being of any one caste isn't what makes you better or worse. What matters is how you live your life, what one's faith and virtue are like. And he asks if only a Brahmin is capable of going to the river and washing off dust and dirt. And of course the Brahmin answers, no. And the Buddha says, well, likewise, all beings are capable of washing off the defilements and following the true Dharma. And it just really impresses me how he sort of takes people's views and he sort of turns them around so that they can see a better truth. And he saw no social bias to join his movement, so whoever came to see him and listen to him, if they were really receptive, they left different how they first came, transformed in some way. So, not surprisingly, he caused excitement and sensation wherever he went. It was sort of this really refreshing new teaching and something that was quite radical that had never been heard around there before, and very clear by this man who people needed to listen to. They really were entranced by his presence. So wherever he went, he taught the Four Noble Truths, and people took the message, and more people went for refuge to him. And as the Bhikkhu Sangha grew, so too did the Buddha's reputation, and it preceded him wherever he went. And one quote appears over and over in the scriptures, and you can feel, I think I can feel the excitement in it. It's a standard sort of paragraph that you find all over the place, but it's just got a sense of real excitement. A good report of Master Gotama has been spread to this effect: the Blessed One is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He teaches the Dharma, which is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. And he reveals a holy life which is utterly perfect and pure. So soon after the first rainy season, very early on, he visited Rajagriha with a retinue of 1,000 newly ordained monks. And they were referred to as the Shakyaputras. And they created a sensation in the city's religion-fueled life. So much so that King Bimbisara held a special reception for them in a grove outside the city walls. And something like, it says, something like 120,000 people came to see the Buddha and the king. And when you imagine that there was only a few million people living in that part of India at the time, that is an enormous amount of people. An interest in the Buddha and the Shakyaputras spread through the city, and the Buddha and his new Dharma came to the attention of other wanderers over this period of time, other Shramanas. And they started to seek him out, either to argue against him or to listen attentively and politely. And the Buddha said those that didn't listen, it was like pouring water into a crack pot. It just came out the other end, went in one ear and out the other, we would say, wouldn't we? But he had his enemies, of course, as well. Collected quite a few enemies. And according to the discourses in the Majjhima Nikaya, one of the Jain leaders, the Nigantha Nataputta, was intent on humiliating the Buddha, who he saw as a rival. And in the Abhaya Raja Kumara Sutta, he tries to trick the Buddha by getting one of his followers, a prince called Abhaya, to ask the Buddha what he called a two-horned question. And I love this sutta. And the question is, would the Tathagata utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable to others? So they think that the Buddha is just cornered here. If he answers yes, then the prince is to say, well, there's no difference between you and anybody else then. And if the Buddha says no, he wouldn't utter speech that would be unwelcome and disagreeable, they would bring up the subject of Devadatta, the Buddha's cousin who was intent on harming the Buddha and taking over. And the Buddha had to put him straight. So he was, in their terms, disagreeable to him. So they thought that whatever the Buddha says, yes or no, then the Buddha was going to just be humiliated. But the Buddha didn't answer like that. The Buddha replied that there was no one-sided answer, and he gave a very clear and skillful answer. And he said to the prince, what would you do if your son was choking? And the prince said, well, I'd put my finger down his throat and pull out the obstruction, of course. And the Buddha said, well, wouldn't that have hurt the boy? And he said, well, yes, but it would have saved his life. And the Buddha said, well, that's the same with me. I'm really concerned about other people's welfare. And if the time is right and what I have to say is true and beneficial to another person, I would say it, even if it is unwelcome and disagreeable, because I'm interested in looking after that person's welfare, just like you would be with your son. So Prince Abhaya was overcome with remorse and immediately became a lay follower and went for refuge to the Buddha. So Nigantha Nataputta's devious attempt to disparage the Buddha failed. He tried again later and failed again. And it was the Buddha's clarity and wisdom that overcame these events. But not all rival teachers were so hostile. There are many instances where one of the disciples, Ananda or Shariputta, would approach large groups of Shramana and engage them in debate, and it was polite and respectful. And sometimes another spiritual leader would be so moved by listening to the Buddha or one of his disciples that he would get his whole community to go for refuge to the Buddha. So this man, the Buddha, must have been remarkable, not least for his kindness and compassion. We all know the famous line of Ananda's just before the Buddha was about to die, where he leans crying on the doorpost and laments of he who is so kind. But there's other evidence as well, the Karaniya Metta Sutta, which some of the words, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world. And his teaching, there was his teaching of the Brahma Viharas, and in the Majjhima Nikaya, the simile of the saw sutta, where he says that even if bandits were to sever you limb from limb with a two-handed saw, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be one of my disciples. So you can be kind to people, whatever they do, whatever they say. And then there was his exhortation to go forth for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare, the good, and the happiness of gods and men. So there was this, you know, we don't often concentrate on the Buddha's compassion and kindness, because there's so many other things, and it's sometimes forgotten about in the Hinayana, in Theravada Buddhism, I think, or it was for a certain time. But there's lots in the Pali Canon about the Buddha's kindness and compassion. So, was it a coincidence that the Buddha was around at this particular time, when northern India was consumed by this fire? Sangharakshita suggested it wasn't a chance event. In what is the Buddha? Who is the Buddha? He says, it's no coincidence that Mozart grew up in an intensely musical society, or that Michelangelo appeared at the height of the Renaissance, or that Shakespeare's honed his skills against a galaxy of dramatic poets, or that Plato lived in a city humming with philosophical inquiry. And he says the same must go for originations of spiritual and religious tradition. The Buddha appeared at just the right time, when the conditions were ripe for him to teach and spread his Dharma. But even so, why did the Buddha have such success? There were hundreds, at least, maybe thousands of other teachers in northern India, and many of, like the Buddha's own teacher, Alama Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta, would be very sincere and very gifted. But something must have set the Buddha apart. His Dharma was fresh and radical, and he was skilled in the way he taught, in the way he tailored his teaching. But there must have been something very special about the figure of the Buddha himself. And these days we can have this sort of stylized image of him, can't we? Clean and neat, in flowing, well-laundered robes. But the human being tramping around India all that time ago must have been very different to that. So let's imagine what he might have been like. Looking at his physical form, we might see just a man, perhaps not even handsome in the conventional way. Certainly grubby, from all the tramping along the dusty tracks, and from sleeping rough, bathing in rivers, whenever he could find somewhere to bathe. He probably wasn't very clean by our shower every other day standards, and he would often be unkempt and unshaven, and his clothes ragged, perhaps a bit of a tramp even, just this wanderer. And yet I think we can imagine that there was something quite extraordinary about him, his directness and his kind piercing eyes that looked right into your very being, and his confident quiet voice, the ease which he went about his world, his openness, his honesty, his skillful speech, the softness of his features and his smile and his approachability. So when the Brahma seller came across the Buddha for the first time, he was astonished by how he looked, this impression of him. And he says, so well fashioned and lovely to behold. Oh, blessed one, your golden is your colour and white your teeth. You are strong. The features are seen by one and all that distinguish a man as well born, with eyes clear, with countenance bright, majestic, erect as a flame, In the midst of this body of recluses, you shine like the blazing sun. So Sela seems to have seen something quite beyond the obvious about the Buddha. A glimpse, maybe even an unconscious glimpse, of something more than the immediate impression. A sense that he was in the presence of something beyond his knowing, something very strong. And Sela converted there and then and became a disciple, as did his followers. So it's no coincidence that so many people who met the Buddha went for refuge to the Three Jewels, or realised stream entry, or even awakening sometimes, right on the spot, there and then. Theirs was no intellectual understanding. For those who went for refuge to the Buddha, there must have been a real revolution, a real turning around in the consciousness, and the whole being, I can imagine, would be shaken to its foundations just by meeting this man, this very special man. So this was the Mahavira, the great hero, as they called him, a true individual whose personal realisation overturned all the confused spiritual theories of the day. And we can only imagine what it must have been like to sit and listen to him. In Jetta Park, where he spent, I think, 24 years of his rainy seasons, 24 rainy seasons in this park. For me, when we went there was a really strong impression of the Buddha being there. And I think something like 800 suttas he taught 800 suttas there. So there was a lot of the Buddha in that particular park. And also the other thing that really struck me, not at the time, but since I've come back, is Vulture's Peak. We went up Vulture's Peak. And now when I meditate, I don't know why, Vulture's Peak is very strong for me. There's a real sense of the Buddha being there. And then the Buddha passed away in his parinirvana. And left a vacuum behind him, no doubt. This man who was so had such presence in the world had gone. And 2,500 years later, I think, you know, we could feel that. We might feel that we can never experience a closeness to him, and never feel the hairs on the back of our necks stand out as he teaches us the Dharma. And never be able to break through into insight, as many people did when they were face to face with him. It'd be easy to imagine that we lack the contact and the closeness that the people of the Ganges Valley enjoyed during those 45 years. But actually, maybe we don't need to feel that. I don't think we do. In the Sutta Nipata, there's the story of Pingya, quite a famous story, who was talking to the Brahmin Bhavari, and he praises the Buddha and his teaching. Now, Pingya was an old man. He was far too old and too infirm to travel and see the Buddha. Yet through his faith, he does indeed see him. And he explains to this Brahmin, sir, there is no moment for me, however small, that is spent away from Gotama, from this universe of wisdom, this world of understanding, this teacher whose teaching is the way things are, instant, immediate, and visible all around, eroding desire without harmful side effects, with nothing quite like it anywhere in the world. You see, sir, said Pingya, with constant and careful vigilance, it is possible for me to see him with my mind as clearly as with my eyes, in night as well as day. And since I spend my nights revering him, there is not to my mind a single moment spent away from him. I cannot now move away from the teaching of Gotama. The powers of confidence and joy, of intellect and awareness hold me there. Physically I cannot move. My body is decaying. I'm old and weak. But the driving power of purposeful thought propels me with it without a break. And the Buddha spoke to him. Pingya, he said, other people have freed themselves by the power of confidence. You too should let that strength release you. You too will go to the further shore beyond the draw of death. So yes, says Pingir to Pfari, I shall go there. I shall go beyond change, beyond formations, beyond comparison. There are no more doubts. You may consider this mind released. So I think we can meet the Buddha as well, just like Pingir did, and do it in our own way. We've got his teaching. We're also fortunate, I think, to have the richness and abundance of later Buddhist tradition, and the expositions of the Dharma as taught by our own teacher, Bhante Sangharakshita. We have our own Sangha and our own spiritual friends to support us. So we're very, very lucky. We've got ideal circumstances. If we want to meet the Buddha, we can meet the Buddha. We've got all the things we need. Even though he's not here in the physical presence, he can be with us. So maybe as we develop and deepen our own faith more and more, we can see the Buddha like Pingir did, with our minds as clearly as with our eyes. And if, like Pingir, we revere him in this way, I don't think we need to spend a single moment away from him, just like Pingir. Right. Okay, I'm just about on time. So I thought now it'd be quite nice to just chant the Shakyamuni mantra for a while. And then after that, while we're chanting the mantra, if you like to go up and make an offering, that's great. There's a bowl at the front here that's got some little Buddhas in it, and you're very welcome to take a little Buddha as just a little souvenir from this morning. These come from Jetta Grove in Ardha Puna. It was Jetta Grove. Yeah. Yeah, I said Sarnath earlier, but it was Jetta Grove. And quite nice, just little tiny bits, but they have got the feeling of that, for me, that area. And do take one if you would like one. And if you don't make an offering, just take one at the end. So we'll have the mantra, which Inga will lead. And then we'll just sit for a little while, maybe, I don't know, 5 minutes or so, and just maybe a little bit longer than 5 minutes, and just try and bring the Buddha into our presence. So you might do this with an image of the Buddha, either the historical Buddha or a golden Buddha, or it might be just a sense of the presence of the Buddha, or the presence even of the enlightened mind. It doesn't have to be any one thing, whatever works for you, and just allowing that, just sitting receptively, letting go, and just allowing whatever arises to arise, and not making a lot of effort about it, but just allowing, if the Buddha will come into our presence, just allowing him to do so. And then I'll ring the bell at the end of that short reflection. So we'll just sit for a little while, a few moments, and then what is it right there? Maybe you could start the mantra.
Muni, muni. Shakyamuni. Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Shakyamuni Sadhu Munimuni Mahamuni Shakyamuni Sadhu.
So I'll end with the transference of merit and self-surrender in call and response. Maybe just try and take away a little of the presence of the Buddha with us. Carry the Buddha with us into the rest of the day. May the merit gained.
May the merit gained.
In my acting thus.
In my acting thus.
Go to the alleviation of the suffering of all beings.
Go to the alleviation of the suffering of all beings.
My personality throughout my existences.
My personality throughout my existences.
My possessions.
My possessions.
And my merit in all three ways.
And my merit in all three ways.
I give up without regard to myself.
I give up without regard to myself.
For the benefit of all beings.
For the benefit of all beings.
Just as the earth and other elements.
Just as the earth and other elements.
Are serviceable in many ways.
Are serviceable in many ways.
To the infinite number of beings.
To the infinite number of beings.
Inhabiting limitless space.
Inhabiting limitless space.
So may I become.
So may I become.
That which maintains all beings.
That which maintains all beings.
Situated throughout space.
Situated throughout space.
So long as all have not attained.
So long as all have not attained.
To peace.
To peace.
Thank you.